If a Muslim kills more than one person, it's called an act of terrorism. If a white male commits a mass shooting, he's called mentally ill. Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we're talking about crime and the mentally ill. While opening up conversations about mental illness seems like a good thing, many people are becoming worried about the misinformation that's frequently part of those conversations. For one thing, people with mental illness are far more likely to be victims of a crime, not perpetrators. And for another, if you say a school shooter, for example, is mentally ill, you don't need to devote time or resources to find out why he did it. The questions stop at the phrase mentally ill. Is our increasing willingness to blame mass shootings on quote-unquote mental illness just a way to throw people with real mental illness under the bus? And if so, what are we really afraid of? Let's meet our guests.
I'm Jackie Buffington Vollum, and I am a professor, associate professor in the Department of Sociology Anthropology at UMD. And my area of expertise and my research and teaching is on mentally ill offenders in the criminal justice system. So I'm heavily involved in the community doing trainings and forensic evaluations and things like that.
I'm Jake Willis with the Duluth Police Department. I'm currently a patrol officer. I'm also a crisis intervention trainer and crisis intervention officer for the police department.
Arthur Chu wrote a fascinating article in Salon saying it's not about mental illness, the big lie that always follows mass shootings by white males. I was encouraged when the conversation following a mass shooting started to talk about mental illness, because there had been no conversation about mental illness, and it wasn't on anybody's radar, and it certainly wasn't anything that anybody thought money should be thrown at. Mm-hmm. But in particular, after reading this article, I am not encouraged anymore. He says that there are statistics showing that the vast majority of people who commit acts of violence do not have a mental illness diagnosis, and people who do are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. And Jackie, I know that that's something that you have some research to support. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, that is actually my primary area of teaching and doing the work that I do. As soon as any crime, not just mass shootings, but any crime occurs that the typical person doesn't understand or understand, the first thing that people go to is, oh, he had to have been crazy, or he had to have had a mental illness. And what the research shows is that, in general, only 1 to 10% of people with serious mental illness will ever commit an act of violence. And most violence that is committed by people without mental illness. For example, murders, only 4% of murders are committed by people with mental illness, which flies in the face of what anyone thinks. And it's absolutely the same thing with mass shootings. As soon as something like that happens, the media immediately jumps to it had to have been a mental illness. And that is a research study that colleagues and I had started back in 2010, looking at how the media covers mental illness and in mass shootings. And the sad part is we couldn't keep up with the number of mass shootings out there and keep up with all the media attention that was, you know, given to it. So at this point, we haven't gotten it published, but it's something that we're continuing to work on.
Is it difficult to try to convince people that somebody can do something so heinous, so inexplicable, without being, air quotes, crazy?
Oh, absolutely. It's actually really interesting. In my classes, one of my classes is on different types of mental illness and crime, and we'll go through the entire semester with me teaching about the different types of mental illnesses and how they relate to crime, especially violence. We get to the end of the semester, and people are like, I don't care what you say. I still believe that that mental illness is the primary factor related to crime. So it is very difficult, even in the face of research, it's very difficult to convince people that that violence in particular is not related to mental illness.
Even though we start as little kids being capable of violence. I mean, granted, let's hope that it's kind of watered down violence, taking a toy away from somebody else, pushing somebody else. We really want to believe that the capacity for violence somewhere along the way only exists in people that are wired wrong.
Absolutely. And what we know from the research, what the research consistently finds is it's not about mental illness. Mental illness might be one risk factor for committing violence, but the most robust factors are those that are risk factors for anyone to commit an act of violence. You know, young adult males, that's a risk factor right there. And that's something that I usually bring up in my class, that actually people, the young men in my class are at high risk and they don't like to hear that. But substance abuse, like, for example, some of the research has found that mental illness, that people with mental illness, yes, may be slightly more likely than the general population to commit an act of violence. The research does suggest that. But that is almost completely explained by co-occurring substance abuse. If a person with mental illness isn't abusing substances, it's unlikely for them to commit an act of violence. So that 1 to 10% of people with serious mental illness that will ever commit an act of violence, that is those people with co-occurring substance abuse and or personality disorder.
Jake, I had Gordon Ramsay in the studio a few months back, and he talked about how the main instance where officers were going to maybe be drawn into a situation where there was violence or a threat of violence was either people that are abusing substances or people with a mental illness. Talk about what your experience has been like dealing with folks with a mental illness.
My experience as a patrol officer, we're frequently called to deal with people with mental illness, primarily because the symptoms that they present of their mental illness are different than getting a runny nose, for example, as a symptom of a cold. The symptoms of some mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, are very in people's faces, and it generates 911 calls. Ideally, we would have someone like Jackie who could show up with the vast knowledge and a lot of degrees and could diagnose the illness and talk to them and figure out what's going on. Unfortunately, what we have is patrol officers have to respond to it because it needs an immediate response. Not because of necessarily a threat of violence, but just the antisocial behavior and the danger to the persons, to themselves, not necessarily to other people. When we respond to these things, it's very high stress. People are on edge, which gives the feeling that violence could occur, if that makes sense. Even though it may not, they're just very agitated because of the things that they have going on.
Adrenaline is pumping. Yeah. The person maybe who called is going, "You're acting weird, and I don't know how to deal with weird."
Exactly. And it scares people. And that's not only from the stigma of mental illness and thinking that people are, as you said, air quotes, crazy, it's just they don't understand it. They just think the person's dangerous. So Chief Ramsey has started an initiative to have everyone on patrol trained in crisis intervention, or CIT, which is an organization that I've been involved with for about 5 or 6 years now. So his goal is within 20 months that everyone on patrol is trained in crisis intervention. Now, crisis intervention teach de-escalation skills. The old way police officers used to deal with mental illness, they'd get there, they'd talk to him for a minute and say, "Well, you're crazy, you're going to the hospital." And that was the reality of police work at that time, that there wasn't anything else out there. What we found is that way of dealing with it, yeah, it solves the problem for that day, but the nature of mental illness is you're going to talk to them again. They're going to be through the system again. The medication may work for a while, and something changes, the medication no longer works. The medication may work for a while, and they may think, "I'm healthy, I don't need to take this." They stop taking it, and they're back in crisis again. they could get to a point where they self-medicate, and now we have the substance abuse issues, which contributes to violence more so than the mental illness itself. So what CIT teaches is to de-escalate the situation. If I can take an extra 15 minutes, de-escalate, get them calmed down, at least show some empathy for what they're going through and show them that I care instead of just hauling them off to the hospital, the next time I deal with them, they'll remember me. And I have had that happen in specific instances where I've dealt with someone again who's all riled up, and then I arrived, and they look and they go, oh, I remember you. And I can get them to go to the hospital without any use of force, without any violence occurring whatsoever. So my experience as a patrol officer, to bring it back to the original question, is that it is a frequent thing that we deal with. It's not necessarily violence, but it gives the impression that violence may occur.
How much of what we fear when we are dealing with someone who has a mental illness, and I would say an untreated mental illness, is just plain embarrassment?
What do you mean?
I'm thinking about an instance where I was standing in line someplace, and there was somebody behind me who kept touching my hair, picking up little pieces of my hair and touching my hair.
Interesting.
Now, I wasn't being hurt. I wasn't in any danger, but I was embarrassed.
Right.
And I wonder if in a culture, a Scandinavian culture like ours,
right,
where you don't raise your voice, you don't gesture with your hands, you don't, unless you're a theater major, speak perhaps loudly and a little bit dramatically, I'm wondering if there are, if some of it is just this discomfort with, I don't know what to expect from you because you're not following the again, air quotes, rules.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that is a big part, particularly in northern Minnesota, the Scandinavian culture. We're very reserved overall here. So someone who's very loud and boisterous and screaming and yelling, it becomes even more intimidating and uncomfortable for people who don't recognize these as being symptoms presenting a mental illness. They're just, the person's not following the rules, and it makes people uncomfortable, and then it furthers the stigma of mental illness. And actually, I've found that just loud people that aren't from here tend to make people uncomfortable.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about crime and mental illness this evening, and our guests in the studio are Jackie Buffington Vollum, a forensic psychologist and professor at UMD, and Patrol Officer Jake Willis with the Duluth Police Department.
We have actually, as a society, we've actually become more fearful of people with mental illness than we were back in the 1950s when we didn't have as many effective treatments. It's counterintuitive. You would think that as we learn more about mental illness and that mental illness is caused by chemical imbalances of neurotransmitters in the brain, as we learn more about it, you would think that people, and that it's a medical illness, you would think that people would become less frightened of that. But actually, the research shows that it's increased by like 250%. The fear of people with mental illness has increased by 250% since the 1950s.
Let's go back to Arthur Chu's article. He says that the stigma attached to mental illness, it costs them relationships, it costs them jobs, it keeps them from seeking help. What is happening to people with a mental illness when the media begins to go on and on and on about a school shooter and the person was mentally ill?
Just from my experience, I was a university police officer prior to working for the city of Duluth. And frequently with schizophrenia, a lot of times the onset comes in the early to mid-20s, if I'm correct. And so working at a college, there were frequent instances where I would get called for somebody who was in the early stages of it, where they're starting to have auditory and visual hallucinations. Now imagine not having this for your whole life, and you're an adult now, and all of a sudden you start having that, and you've already developed this cultural stigma that, oh my gosh, I might be crazy, is what they think in their head, when in fact it's an illness that's treatable. So from a police perspective, handling that stigma with somebody who has, they have the stigma already and they've now developed the mental illness, is incredibly difficult to get around. And that's where the crisis intervention becomes key, in that we can show empathy. We can show ways, we can help them understand that it's a symptom that can be treated instead of treating them like they're crazy, which, as we said, that stigma has already been developed at that point.
And listening, Jake, to what you just said, it occurs to me that people feel that crazy is a summing up of them in their entirety.
Right.
To teach people that you can have a mental illness, it doesn't mean you're crazy. It means you have a chemical imbalance.
The language that we use, the terms that we use for mental illness, it's become such a... it's woven into our language. I'm always very careful about not referring to people with mental illness as a schizophrenic or, you know, the mentally ill as a group. I refer to them as people with mental illness. And I'm very careful about doing that in my classes. One of the exercises in my mentally ill offenders in the criminal justice system class that I have my students do early on is just to pay attention to how many times you hear the word crazy throughout the course of the day. Just take one day and really pay attention to how many times you hear that. It's everywhere. You hear it dozens of times in the course of a day. If they don't come away with anything else from my class, I just hope that they understand the aspect of stigma and how that affects people.
Who's said to their kids, "You're running around like crazy. Knock it off."
Right.
Who has not said to a friend, laughing and meant as a compliment, "You're crazy. You're nuts." If we take that word away from people, which, you know, there are a lot of words that we're saying, yeah, we want to take those words away. And so I'm not objecting to that. But what word do we put in its place?
It's so funny that you say that because I deal with this a lot. For example, with my son, he's 5 and I'm already trying to teach him not to use the word crazy, not to use these words that can be offensive to people with mental illness. And I even struggle with that sometimes. I'm like talking and I usually use the word wild. Or something like that. But it is a challenge because it's so ingrained in our language that it is really hard to be conscious of that and to, to try to change your language.
And from a training perspective, as far as the crisis intervention team training goes, the term that we use is consumer, meaning a consumer of mental health services. So we use consumer. The problem is getting that into people's vernacular and making it a common term is difficult. I've found in dealing with people, sometimes I'll ask them if they're familiar with the term consumer. When I start to pick up on this person might need some mental health help, maybe their medications are off. So before I just say, "Do you take any medication?" I'll ask people, "Are you familiar with the term consumer?" If they go, "Well, you mean someone that buys stuff?" Then I know, okay, I got to take a different angle. But if I've had a couple of instances where they look at me and they go, "Yeah, okay." And it's an instant thing for them to recognize, okay, this guy probably gets it, and they become more comfortable with me. So through crisis intervention training, that's one term that we use to replace saying mentally ill, or we would never say crazy. You avoid that completely. And like you said, avoiding it in your general day-to-day is important too.
One of the other things that Arthur Chu talks about in his article, what he hears from people who, quote, bleat on about the real issue of mental illness, when pressed for specific suggestions on how to deal with said real issue, is terrifying nonsense designed to throw the mentally ill under the bus. Part of this whole moving people out of institutions and saying your community is going to take care of you means that people have the right to take their medication or to not take their medication. They also have the right to discharge themselves from the hospital into a homeless situation and into a place, we've talked with Deb Holman about this, yeah, into a situation where there's nobody who can watch over them and make sure that they're taking their meds, that they're looked after.
I don't think there is an easy solution. I think we're working towards it. And as I said, Chief Ramsey's intention of having all officers trained in CIT, because frequently a lot of the homeless population is due to mental illness because they have a difficulty functioning in life. They have a difficulty dealing with the day-to-day because their symptoms are so overwhelming. There's one person in particular in Duluth that we have been around frequently. He's very mentally ill, auditory and visual hallucinations. His hygiene was getting terrible. He was trespassed from almost everywhere in the city, and it was difficult because I had a decent rapport with him. So when I get called there, I never had fear that he was going to hurt anybody or anything, but it was getting to the point where I was afraid that somebody was going to hurt him. Or he would injure himself, not intentionally. He wasn't suicidal or anything like that. And it got to the point where I finally had to bring him to the hospital, and I signed a 72-hour hold as a peace officer on him, and I filled out a very lengthy description of why he should be held, articulating, you know, my fear that somebody else is going to hurt him because he's not caring for himself. He's developed new physical symptoms I could observe, such as tics and movements and different things like that. And difficulty understanding places he wasn't allowed. So I did this long thing, and the doctor agreed with me, but he said, we have no beds. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a difficult situation then, because the doctor thinks he should be held but has nowhere to put him. Now, he can medicate him for that day. He's on a 72-hour hold. He can keep him there for a little while and force medication in that time, but he can't keep him forever. So it becomes a community caretaking thing. As you said, Deb Holman is an incredible advocate for the homeless, and not only just the homeless, but the mentally ill homeless. And she talks to people. I heard one person I talked to her called her the street angel. That's what her nickname is.
Yeah.
And it's completely true. And she can't fix everything, but she's trying to do as much as she can. And she's working intimately with the police department, Officer Drozdowski, who's very involved deeply with CIT and working with the downtown homeless. To bring it around to answer your question again, I digressed a little bit, but what is the answer? I don't know. I think we're trying to do the best with what we've got and trying to help people when we can help them. Unfortunately, the way the law is set up, unless they're a danger to themselves or others, we can't force them to do anything. So the balance is, who decides when a person's liberties are taken away? Mm-hmm. Who decides when you can decline medical treatment? So, for example, could Dr. Buffington have a person there and say, yep, you definitely need to be committed, we're enforcing medication, but you only have this, so you're not going to, you know, who decides that?
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about crime and mental illness this evening, and our guests in the studio are Jackie Buffington Vollum, a forensic psychologist and professor at UMD, and Patrol Officer Jake Willis with the Duluth Police Department.
You probably both know more about the economics of this than I do, but my understanding is that using hospitals and jails to treat people with mental illness is about the most inefficient, mm-hmm. wasteful, and expensive method of treatment that we could possibly come up with.
It's a very economical and political decision. What we're talking about, it's referred to as civil commitment. As part of my forensic evaluations, I do have to make a determination about whether the person should be civilly committed because they're a danger to themselves or others. And in many states, they also have this grave disability prong in which people can be hospitalized against their will, medicated against their will. As you said, back in the, prior to the 1950s, it didn't take much for someone to get civilly committed. As you said, a husband could bring in their wife and say, she's being difficult. And she could be civilly committed with nothing more than a basic hearing before a magistrate who pretty much just took the word of the husband. I worked at state hospitals in the state of Virginia, and when they finally started, it's referred to as the deinstitutionalization movement, where they released hundreds of thousands of people into the community. And it was actually a really tragic situation. It was a good idea in theory, but they didn't appropriate enough money to actually develop this community network, this community mental health service network. But they finally went through all the state hospitals and examined each individual's case to determine, does this person still need to be in the hospital? There was a woman who had been there for 40 years. 40 years and did not need to be there because she wasn't a danger to herself or others, and never had been. But in terms of it being a political and economical decision, as you said, you know, it's a pendulum swing. We, back in the 1950s, we hospitalized civilly committed way too many people against their will. Now we're at the opposite end. And Minnesota in particular is at a, Minnesota is has among the lowest number of state hospital beds per capita. And, you know, there are pros and cons to state hospital beds. I'm actually very much a patient's rights advocate. But we know there will always be a segment of the seriously mentally ill population that does need inpatient treatment. And the expert's minimum standard is that states should have 50 state hospital beds per capita, 50 state-run psychiatric beds per 100,000 people in the state. Minnesota has three per 100,000 state hospital, or three state hospital beds per 100,000 people in the state. So we are sorely lacking. And I actually believe that that also contributes to stigma, is that there are people who need inpatient treatment who are, there aren't enough state hospital beds. So they're out in the community. The community sees that, becomes uncomfortable, and it contributes to the stigma.
And from a criminal justice perspective, it is taxing on the court system also, because from our side of things, there's frequently people that the only way we can force them to be medicated or get treatment is through the court system, by repeatedly citing them for minor violations that they consistently commit, which is a quality of life issue for the citizens of the city. But we get them into the court system where they can be evaluated by someone like Jackie and through the courts, and the courts can order them to be medicated. But that takes time, and it's very taxing on the court system. And jail is not the place for these people. But unfortunately, if they're going to hurt themselves or they're going to be hurt by other people, eventually that's where they end up. That's just the way that it goes sometimes. But eventually, with mental health court in St. Louis County and other resources such as Bridge House, we're starting to get them into treatment quicker, to get through the court system where the court recognizes this isn't a criminal issue. So they're never convicted of a felony. They're never convicted of any serious crimes, but they're convicted, they're brought through probation and different things where the court can order them to go through certain procedures, and they have to attend treatment. They have to take their medication or that probation will be revoked. Mm-hmm. And that's a way that we're making people take their medication that need to.
The irony of it is that in order for someone to be civilly committed, they have to be proven to be a danger to themselves or others. But these days, with the lack of hospital beds, if they become a danger to others, which is grounds for civil commitment, they're instead put in jail. And I mean, many people would say that's an appropriate place, but for people with the severity of mental illness that I'm evaluating, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, it is a toxic environment, and it's very damaging to them. And it actually, as you said, it actually is more expensive, because most of the time they're taken to jail. But people with really the severe mental illnesses, they're going to have to go to the hospital anyway because they can't be managed at the jail. So if we just, you know, took out the jail from the equation and just get them the treatment that they need in an inpatient setting, we would save a lot of money.
Yeah. And in the police department, we're trying a lot of different angles. The other thing we're trying to do to avoid it getting to that point is we now have an embedded social worker with the police department who works directly with Officer Robertson, who's another CIT trainer. And they are actually out on the street, and they can't be there 24/7, obviously, but they are out on the street. And when we go to calls that we recognize, there's nothing immediately that we can do from a patrol perspective. We can refer it to Officer Robertson or to the social worker, Ms. Flipovich, who's embedded in the police department, and say, this is something that needs follow-up. If they're not there, we can also send an email. I've gotten emails from cases where I've gone to where they've just seen the notes on it that I've typed in the computer in the car about what's going on, and I've gotten emails from the social worker saying, do you think this is mental illness? Is there something that I can do to try to help this person? So, you know, the immediate response initially, I can't force anything. I check on them, I talk to them, I offer assistance. If they don't want it, I can't force it, but I put notes and it is followed up on. Now, can they turn the social worker down as well? Absolutely they can, but sometimes that person coming to offer assistance is different than a uniformed police officer coming. And by nature, the uniform is somewhat intimidating. That's the intent of the uniform. That's part of it. Officer presence is part of the use of force options to an officer. That's the intention of it. So it's difficult when we're also called upon to respond to someone in mental health crisis. Now, I can't take my uniform off and then, okay, this is a mental health crisis. I'm going to take my uniform off and change clothes and seem more friendly. So you have to learn techniques to try to make yourself less intimidating and be more friendly. So it doesn't always work, and often that social worker that's now embedded in a pilot program on a grant with the department, that can help with some follow-up. So we are trying to avoid having to go through the court systems if at all possible.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. Thanks to our guests, Jackie Buffington Vollum, a forensic psychologist and a professor at UMD, and Patrol Officer Jake Willis with the Duluth Police Department. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.